I'm thirsty. Just think how many times you hear that when you're at the sports field with your kids or out on a hot summer hike or just driving around in the car. Water is obviously a go-to, but have you ever thought about healthy hydration? Element is a zero-sugar electrolyte drink mix born from the growing body of research revealing that optimal health outcomes occur at sodium levels 2 to 3 times government recommendations. Electrolyte deficiency or imbalance can cause headaches, cramps, fatigue, brain fog, and weakness. Element helps anyone stay hydrated as each stick pack delivers a meaningful dose of electrolytes free of sugar, artificial colors, or other dodgy ingredients found in popular electrolyte and sports drinks. That's why Element is trusted and used by everyone from the Olympic weightlifting team, NFL and NBA players, Stanford neuroscientists, and everyday moms like me. Our kids actually fight over them. We keep the stick packs with us when we are on the go. They're super convenient. Head directly to our exclusive page at drinklmnt.com/1000hours to receive a free Element sample pack with any order. That's drinklmnt.com/1000hours to get your free sample pack with your order. Okay, here we go. Welcome to the 1000 Hours Outside podcast. My name is Ginny Urich. I'm the founder of 1000 Hours Outside, and I'm so excited. I've really been looking forward to this. Annabelle Abbs Streets is back. Welcome.
Hi, Ginny. It's very nice to be back chatting with you.
One of our most popular podcasts is about your book, 52 Ways to Walk, which someone had recommended to me at a conference I was speaking at. They came up and they said, I love this book, and I immediately grabbed a copy and been so honored to get to connect with you about that book. But what was so fascinating about it was, how could someone make a book about 52 different ways to walk? First of all, how could you come up with that many ideas, but make it so interesting? And it was one of those books that I was like, oh, wow, this is so interesting. Like the whole book, I just love it. 52 Ways to Walk. It's been one of our most popular podcast episodes with you here on the 1000 Hours Outside podcast. And this year, 2024, you came out with a new book called Sleepless, Unleashing the Subversive Power of the Night Self. And Annabelle, this was so similar. I mean, it just like drew me in. I was like, this is so fascinating. I've never heard about so many of these things before. So I guess I shouldn't have been surprised at how much I liked it, considering how much I liked 52 Ways to Walk. But it was a topic I didn't even know I should like, and it turns out that I love it.
Oh, good.
So let's talk about the story here. This was not what I was expecting. You start off this book by saying, I went on this journey that I didn't expect to take, a journey that would have once terrified me, a journey into darkness and sleeplessness. And so my thought was that it was going to be this story of, I'm going to challenge myself. I'm going to go out into the dark. I'm going to sleep out in the dark. And you did do some of those things, but it wasn't spurred on by this thought of delving into that. It was spurred on by life circumstances, where all of a sudden you're finding that you can't sleep and there's been loss in the family. And that took you on this journey of learning about, I guess there's all sorts of people that thrive at night in different ways. So can you tell us a little bit about this journey that you went on?
Yeah, sure. So it's a sad story, really, in the beginning, but it's one of those stories that actually has a sort of, I guess, a sort of silver lining. So back in 2020, if you cast your mind back to the pandemic, and we were sort of in the UK, we were cycling in and out of lockdowns, and this was just coming up to Christmas. There was still no vaccine, but there was talk of it. But we didn't know when it was going to be rolled out. And at that stage, just before Christmas, my family suffered from 3 losses that came, you know, really close together in a period of 6 weeks. So as my stepfather died, then my father died, and then we bought a puppy to try and, well, help us heal, really, and the puppy died. So in 6 weeks, we lost 3 people. None of them were COVID deaths. And none of them were expected. You know, you don't get a puppy and expect it to die. My father had just had, you know, a clean bill of health from his physician. So none of this was expected. So there was a sense of shock, I think, and unreality about it. But because I'm the oldest daughter, and, you know, my stepmother and my mother were suddenly, you know, bereaved and in isolation, and all my kids, you know, we were all, everyone, all of us at home. I had to organize everything and manage everything and sort out the funeral, lockdown funerals and obituaries and eulogies and justice for the puppy and just everything. You remember how it was in the pandemic? It was just so busy. The shopping, the cooking, the homeschooling, everything. So I had to keep the show on the road, and I took it upon myself to be the person to do that, which meant that my days were really busy. But at night, I could not sleep. And first of all, I just thought, oh my gosh, this is going to be awful. I'm going to have to drag myself around. I mean, I was grieving at night because I didn't have the time during the day. And I didn't want my kids to see how unhappy and upset I was, because they were too. So night then slowly became my refuge. It was my place of sort of salvation, really. It was a place where I could think and grieve and ask questions and do things I didn't normally do, like pray and just try and remember things about my father and my stepfather, memories I didn't want to lose. So night was suddenly opened up as this completely different place. But before that, I had always been quite frightened of the dark and really anxious about insomnia, which I'd had off and on since the birth of my first child. So I'd always had a problem with sleeping, and suddenly this was, it was all night I was awake. But I had two choices at that point, which was one to go to my physician and ask for sleeping pills, and the other choice was just to embrace it. And I thought, I don't want to take the sleeping pills. I really didn't want to do that. I thought, I'm just going to go with this and I'm going to see where it goes. Not having any idea that it would end up with me, sleeping outside and doing night walks with my kids and night swimming and all of these sort of, I mean, looking back now, I call them adventures, but at the time they were more like distractions from all the grief. So that was where it started. But in this process of discovering what I call in the book my night self, I realized that at night I'm quite a different person. And I thought, well, maybe this is just me, or maybe it's because I'm grieving. So at that stage, I started to do two things. I started to dig around in letters and memoirs, diaries, journals from women of the past. And also, I started reaching out to neuroscientists and sleep scientists and trying to understand why I was thinking differently. But the research, the historical research, looking at women of the pre-sleeping pill past was absolutely fascinating, because you find in their letters and diaries the sense that women have never really slept very well. So, we didn't have hospitals till about 150 years ago. Before hospitals, women in the villages and the towns were the primary carers. They were all working the night shift. So women have always worked the night shift. And there were those who were up all night with babies and looking after elderly relatives, looking after the neighbors, looking after everyone in the community. There were also those who were very busy during the day with, the household, and often again with lots and lots of, 10, 12, 15 children. And they would carve out time during the night just for themselves to do something, often something creative that they couldn't do during the day. So that was often, writing poetry, or it was drawing, or it was studying, or it was looking at the stars. But those were the two main camps of women that I found. But I also, and one other camp were, of course, women who were very spiritual and found that time of the night was really conducive to prayer and to having a more direct communication with God. So you sort of had these three camps of women: the nuns and the very religious, who were being incredibly spiritual and using the nights to pray; the group who were trying to snatch some time for their own creativity and self-expression; and then the group of carers who were just, up all night looking after sick people, and often tragically looking after dying children and dying parents. So these women really fortified me, because I thought, okay, if these women have been up all night, I can start by not sort of stressing about the fact that I'm awake when I really should be asleep, because we've done this. And at this stage, I also ended up speaking to a biologist at Cambridge University, who said to me, oh, don't worry about it. Women are adapted. We are evolutionarily adapted to be awake at night, and it's not as bad for our health as it is for men. He pretty much said, if women hadn't been able to cope with sleepless nights, the human race would have died out. And I thought, that's absolutely right. So I stopped. So I got rid of all that anxiety about, oh God, I really should be asleep. I really should be asleep because I knew I wasn't going to sleep anyway. And then I decided to look at what all of these various women had done and try and do it myself. So whatever they did, I did. And that was really where the journey started.
Wow, Annabelle, what a fascinating topic that I didn't even know was a topic. And then when you went through authors and poets, and this one's doing embroidery and all these things over the past several hundred years and finding their journals or their diaries and their things that they wrote about, I didn't even know this. And people that you've heard of, you know, these are famous people that you've heard of. And I had no idea that this was a thing. And I do think, Annabelle, what a message of hope, because the sleep piece is kind of stressful. Like, you got to get this much. I mean, people are talking about it constantly.
Yeah, I know certainly that when I was, and you'll have been in the same boat, Ginny, when you've got lots of small children, I had at least a decade where I was up every single night, two, three, four times,
Yes.
feeding a baby, caring for an unhappy toddler, comforting another child that's had a nightmare. It goes on for years, and yet we're constantly told that, if we don't have this perfect segment of 8 hours sleep, we're going to get Alzheimer's, we're going to die early, we're going to get type 2 diabetes. But the data doesn't really support this for women. It's a little bit more detrimental for male health.
It's interesting because everyone who's talking about it is a man. Like anyone who I've talked about to who is touting, you got to get the sleep, you got to get the sleep, has been a man. But what an interesting thing to say that throughout all of human race that women are caretakers and you've got children that are throwing up. I mean, this is just how it goes. And there is a lot of anxiety around not getting enough sleep. And so I found that this book was very comforting.
Good, good. Because it is the message now, and the message didn't used to be like this. If you go back again through the journals of women, even 50, 60 years ago, there's no sense of, oh, I haven't had my 8 hours sleep, I'm going to die, I'm going to be dreadful, I'm not going to be able to perform. They just didn't have access to any of these headlines. So they just thought it was fine to feel a bit tired, and they just got on with it. And then, you'd have a run of bad nights, and then you'd have a really good night because you're so much in sleep debt, and then you'd get back on the sort of treadmill, really, of sleeping sometimes. And also, I think a lot of them slept differently from the way we sleep. So the idea of being awake in the night was quite normal. So there was this whole idea of biphasic sleep. And if you look at diaries, and this was for men and women, if you look at diaries of Samuel Pepys, for example, who's this very famous British man who kept a huge diary of his life, every minute of it. And he talks in his diaries about, often waking up at 2 or 3. He would go next door and have a cup of tea with a neighbor. He would sit by the fire and read a book. He would go and do a bit of work. He'd do some of his accounts and his bookkeeping. And the sense that it was quite normal to be awake in the night was something I found also in all of the diaries and the journals of the women who didn't have to get up necessarily to care for sick children. It was just quite normal they would wake up. And that's often when people would pray. So we are now told that we need to sleep in this 8 hour chunk because really it suits our industrial nation when, employers want everyone to turn up at the same time to be, at their most profitable and productive for a period of time, and then they want them all to go home as, like a bunch of machines. But we're not machines, and a lot of people sleep differently, and a lot of people are more owlish and some are more larkish. And some people need more sleep than others. And also the thing I thought was, we've just forgotten how to rest, really. We rush around all day and then we sort of lie there panicked because we can't go straight to sleep. So for me, part of this journey was also about learning how to rest, which I had to do during the day because often I'd be up all night. So the days would be, tired, and I had to sort of learn how to get, 10 or 15 or 20 minutes rest during the day so that I could then get through the rest of the evening.
So interesting. It's so interesting that you thought to go back to all of these other people and to consider how life was for them. I would have never thought to do that. So this turned out to be this absolutely fascinating journey of a book, person after person after person. One of the things you said, which I think is a huge thing, like a huge statement, Annabelle, I make a pledge to myself. I will never, ever worry about my sleep, the quantity, quality, or shape of it again. I mean, I think this is one of the things we worry about the most.
Yeah. Yeah, and in fact, I did come across several reports, the studies looking at people awake in the night, that showed that the stress you experience with your sleep anxiety is more detrimental to your health than actually being awake. So I found that on the nights, I found that on the nights where I got up and went and did something creative, I would write or I would draw, or as you know from the book, I go out night walking, I go night swimming, I go and look for nocturnal insects, all sorts of things. I found that on those nights, in the mornings, I didn't feel tired. I felt a little bit exhilarated. Like it's a bit like, those nights when you go to a really good party, you don't get quite enough sleep, and the next morning you should be tired, but actually you're on a bit of a high, aren't you? You're just thinking about the party and the people you talked to and the interesting conversations you had and who was wearing what, compared to a night where you've been awake and you're just lying there thinking, oh God. Oh God, I've got to get up in a minute. I've got to get the children off to school. I'm not going to be able to string a sentence together. Those nights were the ones where in the morning I would be exhausted, from the stress, I think, of lying there getting anxious.
It's a really different framing to look at it that way. And it's a life-changing framing, especially with all of this information swirling around about this by this time and the REM sleep and the, I mean, there's so much to it. And yet I look at my own life too, and a lot of it has been sleepless. It's even this piece of, I think so often women work. This is when you work. I mean, once my kids go to sleep, either I'm getting up early or I'm staying up late. That's the only time that is available to work. And so to not necessarily feel super guilty or extremely concerned about that either is very freeing. So we have, I love this phrase, night self. Never heard of it. Did you make it up?
Yes, but it's not very imaginative. Night
Oh,
self.
your night self. Okay, so this is,
Very
I mean,
isolated.
this is a new thing that Annabelle Abbs Streets has come up with, your night self. And the whole thing here is that biologically, we are different at night, which I never considered. The only thing I'd ever heard of is that your milk changes. Like if you're nursing your baby, the composition of the milk, the melatonin, that will change at night. But I've not really heard anything about our biology, but you're talking about so much saliva, blood, bones. What is our body? What is our night self like?
So at night, lots of things change in our body. So our blood pressure falls, we start shedding skin, we metabolize alcohol more slowly. It's all sorts of strange little things that start taking place. The hormones change, so we stop producing serotonin, which is the hormone that we sometimes call the happy hormone. It's the hormone that makes us feel sort of very cheerful and upbeat. So we don't produce that at night. Cortisol is at its lowest level, I think, at about midnight. And the cortisol is sometimes called the stress hormone, but it's also the hormone that keeps us sort of energetic and alert and focused. So that's at its lowest point. Obviously, we're producing melatonin, which is there really to help us tell us to go to sleep. And another hormone called leptin, which stops us feeling hungry. And that is because people think that's because in the past it was really important that we didn't wake up in the night feeling hungry, because then we would have gone out of our cave, gone foraging and perhaps been attacked by a predator. So lots of these changes are really sort of rooted in evolution. They were there to protect us when we did live as hunter foragers and possibly in caves. So they're not really relevant to the lifestyle we have today. So that's what's happening in the body, lots and lots of changes, but also lots of changes are happening in the mind. And while I was researching the book, I started writing it, a report appeared on my table, on my desk, called The Mind After Midnight. And I was really pleased, because before this, I'd been sort of fumbling along thinking, well, I'm a bit different at night, but maybe everyone else is completely normal. Maybe it's only me who has a night cell, and maybe that's because I'm grieving. But The Mind After Midnight, which was written by a researcher in Arizona and his team, they looked at the awake at night brain for the first time. No other studies had looked at people awake in the night. They looked at, dreams and sleeping people and sleep-deprived people the next day, but no one had looked at that brain awake in the middle of the night. And they found that we are really quite different at night. So they were looking at more the more negative aspects. So they discovered that, reformed smokers were more likely to, have a cigarette in the night. reformed alcoholics were much more likely, if they were awake in the middle of the night, to go and get a drink of alcohol. People who were on diets, they were fine during the day, but if they were awake at night, they were much more likely to tuck into a huge slice of chocolate cake. So it seems that the night brain is a little bit more, slightly more reckless. It's not so self-disciplined. I knew from my own experience that my night brain is a little bit disordered. So during the day, I'm quite organized and everything is in sort of lists and it's all sort of carefully mapped out. But at night, I couldn't really think like that. My brain really thought in a more in a much more imaginative and creative way. So ideas, a lot of my ideas would come at night and I would write them down and then look at them in the morning. So the day brain is much better at assessing and evaluating, measuring, monitoring, putting things in nice straight lines. The night brain doesn't really work quite like that. And this is because, well, one main reason really, we think it's because this part of the brain that sits just behind our forehead, it's called the prefrontal cortex. That bit of the brain, it's our most evolved brain part, and it's very, very good at being organized and methodical and judgmental. That bit of the brain, and control, it controls all our emotions. It makes sure we behave appropriately, that we don't do daft things, we don't upset people. That when that part of the brain sort of quiets down, goes to sleep at night, it needs to rest because it works so hard during the day. It goes into sort of partial hibernation at night, and that seems to free us to behave in a slightly different way. So that seems to be, and the interesting thing about that, actually, I should just say, is this prefrontal cortex is bigger and more active in women, which again makes sense from an evolutionary point of view. We always had to be slightly more organized because, while the this is the thinking, while the men were out hunting, which is very focused, isn't it? You're just chasing that antelope. The women were having to work out where to forage and had they got all the children and had they got all the elderly people. So it's a slightly different sort of brain. And women, I think we also have a much stronger inner critic. That little voice, that little judgmental voice that sits on your shoulder and tells you're no good at that. And that's not something you should be doing. You're not creative. You're not good at art. You're not good at embroidery. You can't do that. That little voice is very bound up with the prefrontal cortex. And at night, that goes away. So I was finding that I would do things at night that during the day I would never have given myself permission to do.
This is valuable. It's a very different reframe. And well, this I just talked to this man named David Thomas, and he was saying that he works as a counselor, and all of these teens come in and they've just said the most awful things in the middle of the night online. And so his point was, don't let your child have their phone in their room, because you do lose this impulse control. And then you wake up in the morning and you've done things or said things that you regret. But on the positive side of that, you're talking about this surge of creativity. And it was interesting because I speak at different conferences, and I don't even know where any of my stuff comes from. Like a lady came up to me one time and she said, "I where did you go to school to learn how to do this? Like, what was your training? I want to do it." And I just, like, as I'm falling asleep at night, in that sort of, that quasi, it's like all that's where all the ideas come. And all I do then is I just write them down, and then that's all I'm doing, Annabelle. It's like, I don't know if there's a school for that, but that's what's happening. Or there was one time I was supposed to speak at this conference, and sometimes you go year after year, so you get kind of nervous because you don't want to say the same things and be boring and repetitive. And I was getting kind of nervous about it. I was like, I don't really know. Usually it just kind of comes. And I'm just like waiting. And so one day it was in a dream. I woke up and there was the whole thing that I was supposed to say. So there's something to this.
That's amazing.
I really related to the book because I felt like there's something about, I guess maybe you're just relaxing and there's change that's happening. During the day, I'm not getting any of the inspiration. And this is common. This is a common experience for a lot of people.
So many people who've read the book have got in touch to say, look, I have all my best ideas at night, and I never understood why. And now they're thinking, okay, it's my night brain.
Yes.
I think it is also partly the fact that it's quiet and people aren't interrupting you and asking for clean socks and cheese sandwiches and whatever. So
Yeah.
there is a sense of peace, I think, but also the
Yes.
fact that your brain is just different pathways open up. So when it gets dark, some pathways close down and other pathways open up, and they're often pathways that we're not familiar with because we're not accessing them during the day.
And interesting because sometimes you're laying in bed and like you said, there's just so much stress, like of trying to fall asleep. Like I gotta fall asleep, so I'm asleep at the right time. But you had talked about how there was this phrase or this thought of resting awake, and that when they compared resting awake with actual sleep, that the memory consolidation that was happening, it was the same. So if I'm laying there and sort of running through, this is what happens, right? I'm sort of running through, I'm speaking next month. And so sometimes that's sort of running through my mind only then, only at night. It doesn't, sometimes I'm like, I hope something comes because I don't know what I would do otherwise. And it's kind of running, but it does feel restful. And yet from the outside perspective, you're kind of feeling like this pressure, like I should stop this and try and sleep. But you're talking about resting awake, it can be beneficial. There's a lot to this. Okay, so a lot for people to look into. Shout out to Claritin for supporting this episode and providing us with samples. In springtime, allergies can sometimes be my kryptonite. When my nose is plugged up and my eyes are watering, I feel like I struggle more to do the things I really enjoy. Making dinner, heading outside to get my sunlight before noon, and even hosting the show can be a bit more challenging. Luckily, for those of us who live with the symptoms of allergies, we can live Claritin Clear with Claritin D. This double action combination of prescription strength allergy medication and the best decongestant available relieves sneezing, a runny nose, itchy and watery eyes, an itchy nose and throat, and sinus congestion and pressure with ease. I've been taking Claritin D for my allergies for several years, and it's been an absolute life changer. My eyes aren't a constant, itchy, drippy faucet, my nose isn't running, and I can speak without feeling like something has jumped in my throat. And I love that Claritin D tackles nasal congestion caused by allergies or cold and also relieves sinus congestion and pressure due to allergies. Ready to live life as if you don't have allergies? It's time to live Claritin Clear. Ask for Claritin D at your local pharmacy counter. You don't even need a prescription. Use as directed. Hair thinning is complicated. The problem is, it's actually much bigger than your hair alone. Like your skin, hair is a reflection of your health, and internal factors can impact the way your hair looks, feels, and grows. Nutrafol's whole body approach multi-targets underlying root causes like stress, hormone fluctuations, and nutrient gaps for visibly thicker, stronger hair. Nutrafol is the number one dermatologist-recommended hair growth supplement, with over 1 million people seeing thicker, stronger, faster-growing hair with less shedding. While many supplements rely solely on ingredient studies, Nutrafol clinically tests final formulations to ensure their efficacy. In a clinical study, 86% of women reported improved hair growth after taking Nutrafol Women's Hair Growth Supplement for only 6 months. Take the first step to visibly thicker, healthier hair. For a limited time, Nutrafol is offering our listeners $10 off your first month subscription and free shipping when you go to Nutrafol.com and enter the promo code OUTSIDE. Find out why over 4,500 healthcare professionals and hairstylists recommend Nutrafol for healthier hair. Nutrafol.com is spelled Nutrafol.com. Promo code is OUTSIDE. That's Nutrafol.com. Promo code OUTSIDE. I thought we could probably talk a whole hour about moths.
I'm with
Because this
you.
is interesting. Tell us about, I mean, there is so much in here. I didn't know. I think that's one of the things I love about your books, Annabelle, is you infuse all these different facts, but it's never boring. It's always like, oh, well, I didn't know that. I want to learn more. Whoa, it's so interesting. So one of the things that you said, there's so many things. Do you want to say some of your favorite parts about moths?
Well, yeah. So the interesting thing about moths is that so if a lot of nocturnal insects aren't really studied very much, so there are still lots of moths that have never been given a name. But there are also hundreds, I mean thousands and thousands of moths, many more moths than there are butterflies. And what we've discovered quite recently, really, is that moths are really important pollinators. So there are lots of plants that don't get pollinated by butterflies and bees, but they do get pollinated by moths. The problem, of course, is that because there's so much artificial light, that's really bad for moths. So moths, certainly in the UK, moths are in incredible decline. If I think back to my childhood, I remember, just looking at car headlamps. Car headlamps were always swarming in moths. You don't see any now. So the depletion of moths is very worrying. But one of my daughters became really interested, obsessed with moths, actually. So she and I would go out moth hunting. We would trap them. We would sort of put up these sheets. You can paint this. You just go online and look for a sort of a moth sugaring. It's called sugaring recipe. And they're usually sort of just syrupy mixtures. And you just paint it on your sheet, and then you go out after dark, hang up your sheet, and the moths come to feed off the syrupy liquid. And you can photograph them or draw them or just look at them. And so many of them were really, really beautiful. But of course, we don't see them because mostly we're up during the day and we're getting very excited about butterflies. But actually, some of the moths we found were extraordinary, so beautiful. And of course, now researchers are discovering that moths are also really, really clever. And some of them migrate hundreds and hundreds of miles. I mean, I had no idea. So I learned a lot about moths and glowworms and fireflies and all of these strange creatures that I didn't even know they existed. Because nighttime for us was always a time really, going inside. Even in the summer, you might sit outside for a bit or play a bit of frisbee or something, but then we'd go inside. So you have to be, when you go out looking for animals in the night, you have to be quite, well, you have to be very quiet. And you have to be quite sort of determined because, of course, you can't see. So it takes longer to see things, to find things. But the great thing is that your olfactory bulb, so your sense of smell, is at its peak after dark. So again, I didn't know this, but we can smell more acutely in the dark. And our hearing is at its most acute after dark as well. So we hear things at night that we wouldn't hear during the day. And sound travels much further. So often you can hear sounds from a very long way away at night that again you wouldn't hear during the day.
Embracing our night self. Okay, these are some of the things I wrote down about the moth. You ready, Annabelle? This is from your book. The book Sleepless. Moths are amazing. They're like flying tongues, tasting everything they land on, and they have ears under their wings. You said they taste with their feet, but many have taste receptors at the end of each hair and scale so that every millimeter of them can seek out food. Some of them can hear through their stomachs. Moths can jam the ultrasonic echolocation capacities used by bats, who are very partial to a moth meal. Some moths have no mouth parts and never eat, living for weeks on the nutrients they stored as caterpillars. Moths can see through their skin. I mean, this is fascinating. It's just like your other book. Well, I was like, wait a minute, I don't know any of this. And then you talked about their cool names. What are some of your favorite moth names?
Oh, they've got the most, some of them have got the most ridiculous names. They're things like the Crimson Footman. So a lot of them are very old names, given to them in Victorian times. So they're often called footmen and butlers, and they've often got colours in. And I've completely gone out of my head, but
Here, wait, I've got it. It's page 170. The hummingbird hawk moth. I mean, who comes up with this stuff? The scarlet tiger. That was a really neat thing too. So you had a bunch of names in there. Equally beguiling are their names. The cinnabar moth, the merville du jour, the green brindled crescent, the crimson speckled footman.
I think that's my favorite.
These are so fun. So just talking about animals at night and insects at night, and this is something that that Paul Bogard talked about in The End of Night, with artificial light at night and how that can actually really affect quite a bit the migration and the mating and those types of things. And so it's something to think about, that these moths are such a gift and what a fun thing to find when you're out in the dark. In terms of other living things at night, you had talked about, and I've got Peter, and I'm not sure if you pronounce it Wohlleben. He's got that book about trees. So I have that
Oh,
one.
yeah, the sleeping trees.
Tell us about that.
Yeah. So my way of countering my own fear of being out was to just just learn all these facts, because I thought if I know all these facts, I'll feel much more comfortable and much less uncertain out in the dark. So I learned all of these for my night walks, really, where I was trying to just expose myself continuously to my own fear of the dark by going out. And so, yes, I turned to Peter Bolobon for tree information, and I learned from him that trees actually go to sleep at night. So they drop their arms, their branches drop down like arms, and they develop a sort of water belly because they can't draw up water through their root system. Because, well, they don't, because they just go to sleep. So they get these little water bellies. So trees at night are a little bit fatter than trees during the day. And I used to, when I was walking around in the woods, I would look at the trees and I would notice how they would, knock me with their branches, which before would have terrified me. But now I just thought, oh, the tree's asleep and hasn't seen me coming.
And he said the forest at night is one of the safest places you could be.
Yeah, he did. He said it's very, very safe. And he also said it is the most, it's where you get, the only place you get true darkness now, because the tree canopy comes over. So you can, in a forest, you can experience the sort of pure darkness that our ancestors would have experienced and that we've mostly lost because of the amount of sky glow. But the problem with the forest, of course, is that we are innately very frightened of being in a forest at night because you can see even less. So that darkness is it's more intimidating to be in a forest, I think, than anywhere else in the night. That was certainly my experience. But once I got into the wood and I had sort of talked my fears down, it was also the most beautiful place probably that I've ever been, apart from night swimming under a full moon. Those two were just absolutely beautiful. And you feel this sense of calm. There's no color. So there's no, all of the color that surrounds us and the noise during the day, that all fades away. So it's very meditative and very calming. And once you've told yourself there are no bears, snakes, tarantulas, or wolves, or anybody else, any humans, I found it to be a really, really beautiful and relaxing experience.
You did all sorts of things with your night self, night walking, into the forest, out of the forest, night swimming. You went to the Arctic Circle. Tell us about that.
Yeah, I wanted to see what it was like to be in 24-hour darkness. So I went there in December, which is obviously the darkest time of the year, and the darkest time of year to be in the Arctic Circle. So I didn't go to the very top where there's no light at all. I went to the top of Norway where there was 1 hour of light a day. So between one and two, the sun never came up, but between one and two, the sky was sort of blue. The rest of the time, it was pitch black. And again, this was something that I thought would terrify me, being in the darkness all the time. And I thought I was going to get very depressed, and because we're always told that too much darkness makes us depressed, which I think it does scientifically in the studies. But I didn't actually find that at all. I found it very, very restful. And there was just a sort of darkness really gives you permission to rest, do nothing, to hibernate. And the skies up there, the night skies were really, really beautiful. And the other thing I'd been thinking a lot about, of course, were how our lives now on our phones and screens, our lives have just become really small and tight. And I just wanted that huge, huge open space. I seem to need it really, as part of the sort of the grieving process. I needed to have big open space. And the nights, there's nowhere as big and open as the cosmos. So when you're lying out, looking out, thousands of stars, and you're just looking for millions and millions of miles. That I found very, very freeing. There's a sense of sort of liberation that comes with that, and you feel as though you're that burden, the burden of the day-to-day life, and in this respect, my own griefs, they just seem to float away.
What an interesting thing that you had written about how the suicide levels peak in the lighter months in the spring and summer and are lowest in December, which will be the darkest of the months. That's opposite of what you would think and sort of opposite of what we seem to be told. Do you think it's because there's a lot of pressure to do, to go, 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 if the days are really long, or is it because there's just this absence of rest?
Apparently, there's two things. So one of them is biological event, really, which is to do with serotonin. We have these receptors in our cells. They help us take the serotonin and turn that into an improved mood, if you like. But those serotonin receptors take, after the darkness of the winter, they take longer to open up again. I'm putting this in the very layman's terms. And so there's a spring about this time of year now, when the days get lighter, there's a sudden mismatch between what's happening in our body and what's happening outside. So that's a biological thing. But the other thing is that I think people talk about the fact that, you're supposed to, everyone is supposed to be happy and cheerful, and spring is about new beginnings. If you're depressed, deeply depressed, and everyone else is talking about new beginnings, and you feel you haven't got a new beginning, that contrast between what is happening outside, the flowers and the birds, and what's happening inside in your life is suddenly much more marked. Whereas when it's dark, you can sort of just lie around in bed and feel depressed, and it seems okay. But come spring, it doesn't feel okay. And I think that can precipitate feelings of quite deep despair.
That's really fascinating because there is this little bit of adjustment too that happens. I think even just on a small scale with parenting, it's like you're having to refigure out. I feel like that with the change, with the big change of the seasons, right? When you're going from the winter heading into spring and summer, there's a lot to reconfigure. It's like what did we wear and who needs what and what did we do and how did we live with the light changing and the different schedule. So yeah, that's really interesting. So just to even be aware of that mismatch that can be happening, and just you got to give yourself a little bit of time to work through it. So you went to the Arctic Circle. This was quite a journey. This podcast is sponsored by Active Skin Repair, a 1% for the planet member who believes personal health and health of the environment are connected. If you spend as much time outside as we do, which we hope you do, or really any time outside at all for that matter, you're bound to have kids that get nicked, scraped, or banged up, or perhaps come in from outside with an unexplained rash, or maybe you end up on the wrong side of a fall or a bad scrape yourself. That's why we love Active Skin Repair. Active Skin Repair is an all-natural and non-toxic topical solution that is formulated to help repair and heal damaged skin. It can be used to treat a wide range of skin issues, including cuts, scrapes, but also burns, sunburns, rashes, and other types of skin damage. It works by mimicking the natural immune response to help soothe irritation, reduce inflammation, and support healing. It's also safe and non-toxic, making it suitable for use on all skin types, including sensitive skin. It's really easy to add to your first aid kit. As if all of that wasn't amazing enough, Active Skin Repair donates 1% of all sales to grassroots environmental initiatives to protect and restore our national world, which is super cool. Visit activeskinrepair.com to learn more about Active Skin Repair and their commitment to 1% for the planet. You can use code 1000hours to save 20% on all Active Skin Repair products. That's activeskinrepair.com. It's no secret. We love music in our household, and music lessons don't need to be expensive, boring, or stressful. Vogtberg Music Academy offers online lessons that siblings can share in the comfort of your own home. Instead of dragging kids to lessons and paying hundreds of dollars a month for one student, use my code OUTSIDE to get 50% off the first month when your children learns piano, fiddle, guitar, mandolin, or ukulele at vogtbergmusicacademy.com. For only $15, get weekly lessons and practice principles, 24/7 access to your instructor, live student onboarding calls, and video vaults that provide dozens of extra lessons for students who want to progress faster. With Vogtberg Music Academy, you will never have to nag your children to practice as they work toward earning badges on their success path and performing for community student showcases. Once again, use my code OUTSIDE to give it a try. You get 50% off this month and give your children a lifelong love of music at vogtbergmusicacademy.com. That's spelled Vogtberg musicacademy.com. And use code OUTSIDE when you sign up. You read about a lot of women. A lot of women. It was one after the next, after the next. Was there a certain woman that you liked studying the most?
Oh, I really liked Jackson Pollock's wife, Lee Krasner.
Yeah.
She is one of my favorites because she was just so, she was so sort of enthusiastic about her fact she couldn't sleep. So when she got to, I think she got to about 51, and suddenly she couldn't sleep at all. So the first thing she did was she would take her dogs for a walk. She thought, I'll take the dogs for a walk and that will send me back to sleep, but it didn't. So instead of just, lying in bed and sort of sketching by candlelight, which is what I do, she just thought, oh, I'm going to get up and I'm going to paint the biggest canvases I've ever painted. And she started to paint huge, huge, huge canvases where she was sort of having to leap and jump to reach the top of them. She was quite short. But she talked about how she couldn't work with color at night. She talked about how she used the brush differently. She would sort of thrust it rather than a gentle dab or a stroke. So everything about her painting was so different. And she just articulates this really well. And this goes on for about 3 years. And they're now some of her most valuable paintings. And then she just stops. She starts sleeping through the night. And that's it. She just goes back to painting and color.
So fascinating.
These women were like my night companions. They kept
Yes.
me company.
And for yours, it was a similar thing where this was a journey of a little over a year, and then things just slowly started to go back. I think that if someone were struggling in this area, or even just a little bit confused, is like that's sort of what I've thought, which is like I've got all these ideas coming at night, or I feel like there are certain times where we drive home from certain conferences and I'll drive through the night. And I feel totally fine. Like it's quiet and everyone's asleep. And I just feel fine, but I feel like I shouldn't feel fine. So then I'm confused about why I feel fine. And then you're second guessing all this stuff. So the book brings a lot of peace as to different situations where you're like, well, maybe this is a little more normal than I realized. And I liked how you had written about how few people had examined the sleepless mind at night, and none had investigated the sleepless female brain. So, if people are listening and they're in a time of mourning or grieving, you talked about your fellow sleep mourners. You know, you're thinking, well, maybe this is going on all over the world. Maybe I didn't even realize. What would you say to someone who's up at night and they're mourning and they're grieving and they're just feeling bad about that because they think they shouldn't be?
Well, if they felt comfortable doing it, I would say get up, get out of your bed, light a candle. Don't turn the lights on, because as we know, that will completely wake you up and perhaps disturb sleeping members of your family and kill your melatonin. And the idea, really, of course, is to go back to sleep eventually. So light a candle, take a maybe some paper or a notebook and a pencil, and my go-to is really to start writing, and that might be journaling, it might be poetry, it might be lyrics. So particularly if you're awake because you're feeling lots of strong emotions, writing them down, I think, is a really good way of just sort of purging yourself of them, really getting them out and getting them down on paper. Sketching, I used to do quite a lot of drawing. I did a lot of stargazing, so I got myself some binoculars and now I have a telescope. So quite often, if the night is clear, I will go out and look at the stars, which I find quite soporific. I slept out a lot. I went through a whole 6 months of sleeping outside and listening to, the nocturne, the night migrating birds that would fly over me, and just listening to the beat of their wings as they went over silently, other than this great beating sound.
That's one of the things that Paul talked about in The End of Night, where he said it's probably one of the greatest wonders of the world is nighttime migration of birds, and we don't even know what's going on. So you heard it?
I heard it. I had no idea what it was. In fact, several things happened
Wow.
on my sleeping out nights that I thought, what on earth is that noise? Or, often it was noises because I could just hear things. I couldn't really see anything. But night migrating birds was one. A lot of geese used to come over, and they don't make any noise, but you hear the wings, the beat of the wings, and sometimes you even feel the breeze coming down from their beating wings. And then you can just see this white shape, and it's just magical. But I heard all sorts of birds. And in fact, I have a little fact. I was so intrigued by this, but 90% of amphibians are active at night. So lots of frogs and toads. 69% of mammals are out at night. So I would hear foxes screeching. I would hear rabbits. I would hear badgers. 50% of birds, which I had no idea of, I thought they were all asleep in their nests. And 60% of insects are out and about. So from, evening crickets through to glowworms and fireflies and earthworms, they're all active at night. We tend to think that, when we go inside and turn off all the lights and get ready for bed, we think the whole world is closing down. But actually, half of the world, half of the natural world,
Was in some cases more than half.
more than half, more like three quarters. And then, of course, the whole night sky is going into moving into action. So my son and I would often lie out. This is not in the middle of the night. This is sort of late evening, really. And we'd watch the comets and the meteors, and we'd watch the moon and the constellations. And I'd never looked at them before. I'd never looked up in my life. I couldn't understand it. I thought, why? My parents had never shown me the night sky, or not that I remember. And this, for the first time, I was looking up and learning the constellations. So I went on an astronomy course and learned to identify the constellations and the stars and the phases of the moon. And that I found that really, really fascinating. And that also was a source of a distraction as well from anxiety and grief and worry. So I would recommend looking at the stars for anyone who's awake at night.
I love the question. This was in the part when you were talking about going to the Arctic Circle. And I don't know if you said it, someone said, why sleep when the sky is so wondrously alive? This is so the opposite of what everyone's saying, though, which is like, sleep, go to sleep. And then you read your book and you're like, well, wait, well, no, maybe I'm missing out on some really, really cool things. Even the night soundscape. I love this paragraph that you wrote. The night soundscape, you're out in the country. I liked hearing the wind, the sheep coughing and beating in the neighboring fields, the groaning and creaking of the willow tree by the front door. Oh, I just love the way you write, Annabelle. I sometimes with authors, I'm like, how did they even come up with this? I liked the way the rain became music at night. It seemed to fall in different notes and keys. What a beautiful way to write, Annabelle, that there's this night soundscape. It's all these like two phrase things that you added, two word things that you added together that, I've never heard of, like the night soundscape. And it's like, oh, it's so enticing. My night self, I just thought, oh, this is such a beautiful writing. It seemed to fall in different notes and keys, the sheets of rain against the glass, the drip, drip, drip on the lead roof, the spongy mizzle spitting into the darkness. I mean, this is just gorgeous, the night soundscape. So now that you have sort of moved out of this phase of sleep mourning, do you find that you're still drawn here and there to do some of these things still?
Yes. Yeah, I now have a group of night walking friends, and we go out night walking. So again, that's not at 2 a.m. We'll go out at 9 and we'll walk till sort of midnight. Although this summer I'm doing it, we're going to do an all-nighter. So we're going to walk all the way through the night and until the sun comes up. Yeah, I'm with my kids, we're going night kayaking. So I've just discovered that there are all sorts of things. I'm going on a night again with my kids, we're going to hear nightingales sing. And another all-night expedition. So things that I would never have looked at before, or identified, or researched, or booked us in for. Now, the diary is filled up with these night adventures and going out with the UV torches. That's one of our big favorite things now. You get a special UV torch and you go out at night. And when you shine that UV torch onto moss, fungi, lichens, slugs, worms, you can see all these extraordinary colors that we think are how birds see them. We think that these are the colors that birds see, but we can only see them by, they're called biofluorescent animals and plants, and we can only see them with the UV torch. But that's something that, kids really love. In fact, kids really love being out in the dark.
Yes.
And this night fear, and I think they used to, and I think perhaps that might be changing because we're so unfamiliar with darkness now. But there's this
Yeah.
little island called Sark, which is off the UK, and it's been a dark sky reserve for I think well over a decade now. So there are no street lights at all on this island, and the schools there take all the children out on night walks to make them feel really comfortable in the dark, because these kids are always going to have to be walking home with no street lights. So no children are frightened of the dark on this island of Sark, but that's just not the case where I am in London. It is much more normal for children to be scared of the dark, or for a lot of children to be scared of the dark. So I think, as parents, one of our roles, I think, is to help our children to feel more comfortable and connected to the darkness and to the night. And that's what I've certainly tried to do with mine. Mine are a bit older now, but they do all love going out in
This
the
is
dark.
so fun. Like I said, night self, night soundscape, UV torch. I mean, what kid does not want a UV
They're
torch? Like,
amazing.
that sounds like it's so fun. I never even heard of that. You had said this too in the book. When our eyes can see for miles and miles, our stress levels fall. And I was thinking about how, so often when we're outdoors, often in a city, or we're often in a spot where there's a lot of homes, maybe you live in a neighborhood, it's suburbia. There's very few places where you can really see for miles and miles. And you're talking about how your stress level falls. And Katie Bowman talks about this, your eyes are able to relax when you can see this long field of vision. But when you're outside at night, the thing to look at is to look up.
Yeah.
And that is an opportunity for everyone, no matter where you live. If you look up and you're out at night, that's when you can see for miles and miles and your stress levels fall.
Yeah. That is the biggest, the longest distance you're ever going to be able to see is to a star or to the
Yes.
moon, to a constellation. It was
Yes.
thousands and thousands of miles. Yeah,
Yes.
it's very, very, it's just very calming.
Yeah.
In fact, there's a guy in the UK who's just written, he's just done a big study of what happens to people who spend a lot of time looking at stars. So I think he mainly was looking at students who did a lot of stargazing. And he did this during the pandemic, actually. He just noticed that they used completely different language. So when the pandemic was over, he went back and did a full study of them. And he said that their sort of levels of mental health and their contentment and their happiness was just much higher than an equivalent group of students who didn't stargaze. So his study came to the conclusion that actually looking at the night sky is really good for our well-being and for our mental health. And I suspect he's absolutely right.
So interesting. This is a book I had no idea that I was going to be so fascinated by. You talk about darkness retreats. There was this study that said 2,000 British adults, 40% are too afraid to walk around their house in the dark. One in 10, so 10% too afraid to even go to the bathroom. So it's an interesting thing to reacquaint ourselves with darkness and with sleeplessness and to change our viewpoint of it. You talk about artificial light. The artificial light at night, especially not using that, like the red light you talked about. So there's so much to learn in here, just like 52 Ways to Walk. I was absolutely fascinated. This page after page after page, I'm like, whoa, I didn't know this. I didn't know that. This is so intriguing. And it really will help me, I think, as a woman who often is not fully getting that exact amount of sleep at the exact amount of times, just to be a little bit more chill with that, just to let it breathe a little bit more and not to be so concerned. So, Annabelle, what a book. What a book. Where can people find it and where can they find you?
Well, the bookshop is in any bookshop or online in all the usual places. And I'm on Facebook and Instagram at Annabelle Abs, Annabelle Abbs.
I love that. It's got a ring to it. The book is called Sleepless, Unleashing the Subversive Power of the Night Self. We didn't dive into it much, but if people are interested in history, I mean, you go through woman after woman after woman that use this power of the night self to do a lot. They were embroidering and writing and poetry. And I loved how you tied it in with your father, who was a poet.
He was, yes, he was.
What a
Yeah.
beautiful legacy, a family of writers.
Oh, thank you. Sadly, I wish he was here to see the book, but
Yeah.
I've sort of found him in the night sky in a way.
Yeah.
So, weirdly, it was a source of solace.
Yes. Well, Annabelle, thank you. What an honor. Not one conversation, but two. Thank you for being here.
Thank you so much for having me, Jenny.
When it comes to raising kids, there's so much to consider. Things like, what do we feed them? When do we feed them? How do they sleep? What does it look like to raise kind kids? How does their nervous system work? How do I keep myself calm? What are my triggers? There's so much that comes into play. And we are distilling all of that information for you at Voices of Your Village podcast, where we bring experts in the field of early childhood and education and psychology and across the board so that you don't have to comb the internet for information. you get to show up and hang out and have shame-free, judgment-free conversations and insights into what it looks like to raise kind, empathetic, emotionally intelligent humans. I'm Alyssa Blask Campbell. I have a master's degree in early childhood education. I'm a mom of two, and I am walking this journey right alongside you doing this work. Come hang out with me at Voices of Your Village, and we can dive into real conversations with actionable tips.